This is Art 11, which means that we have one more lecture on art, but two more in the sequence. The sequence always follows a very classic form. The form is to have three parts that are equal and a fourth part that is like a punctuation. It's like writing the talismanic word Om, writing it A-U-M exclamation mark. So there are four parts, but three of the parts play a structural role, and the fourth part is like a coda, completing the form but not interfering with the great triangle of the structural integrity. In the West, for 2,500 years, this has been an archetypal form of dramatic presentation. And the creator of this form, the very first human being to ever make this form and use it, was a classical Greek named Aeschylus. And Aeschylus, who did a dramatic presentation in 472, BC, gave a trilogy of plays with a fourth play that was a satyr play. And the middle play of the three Greek tragedies, this was the first Greek tragedies ever formally presented on stage. The middle of the three tragedies, because Greek tragedies were always trilogies, followed by a fourth play, which was not a part of the trilogy, but was always a satyr play, a kind of like a absurd comic relief. Not comic. But after three tragedies in a row, the punctuation was an exclamation mark to assure you that these plays were not presented to be downers, but they were presented to be forwarders. The middle tragedy is the only one surviving from that early quartet. And the middle play is called The Persians. Now this form of 1, 2, 3, ellipsis, 4, is the form that we also use in this particular education. We have three sets of four lectures, like three squares, that are placed one after another in a secession, if you experience it, because they displace one another. And those three sets of four are followed by a 13th lecture, which is not a part of any of those sets of four and not a part of that structure of 12, but nevertheless is a punctuation mark. And so the 13th lecture is always called an interval. It's like a musical form where you have your musical form expressed in three sets of notes, of configurations, followed by an interval. And the point is that the interval counts. The interval makes it possible to move to a higher order. If you count 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 is a part of the cardinal series. But if you count 1, 2, 3, 40, 50, 60, 700, 800, 900, 10,000, you're counting in terms of three steps of sequence and a fourth step that goes to yet a higher order. It changes the way in which movement, which was originally cardinal, becomes ordinal. And because when movement is limited to cardinality, to that kind of a sequence, it tends to gain more power than we can handle. A complete, long cardinal sequence is the essence of ritual. The importance is not to miss a single number. And the longer you keep doing this, the more have a kind of hypnotic control the sequence has over you. So the longer the integrity of a ritual, which then becomes a tradition, the longer the tradition holds, the less personal say you have in the matter. And when the cardinality of tradition reaches thousands of years, who are you to question it? But if the cardinal sequencing is transformed into an ordinal stepping, then what happens is that there's a revolution built into the ritual, a revolution which ups the ante every so often and inculcates into the very ritual structure a revolutionary technique of transcendence. Because once you build into a ritual sequence the ability to transform it, which in essence, in terms of counting, is to recalibrate it, 1, 2, 3, 40, 50, 60, 700, 800, 900, 10,000. You're recalibrating the whole cardinal meaning. And even though one can still recognize that one is following some kind of a sequence which has cardinality as a quality to it, it also has ordinality as a part of its structure, and you then ritually inculcate into yourself the ability to be able to count on transcendence being a part of the way in which a tradition then works. This is the difference between ritual and art. Ritual is healthy when it remains on that horizontal line of cardinality. A good ritual is where you do it the same way that your forefathers did it. But in art, the importance is to not only do it the way your forefathers did it, but with the ordinal stepping up of jumping transcendently to higher orders. And this is not an infinite process, because as soon as one steps up four times, actually three times opens the whole issue, but the fourth step is one to infinity. Once you build into a ritual tradition a revolutionary freeing new order four times, you can do it forever. You ritually build in freedom, the capacity for freedom, into the tradition. When one begins to understand this, you begin to understand that Aeschylus is one of the world's great geniuses. But it's not so much Aeschylus alone who develops this form. The contemporary of Aeschylus was Pindar. Pindar is the world's first really great lyric poet. Pindar's poems are about the Greek athletic contests at Olympia, at Nemea, at Isthmian. But those poems are not just the celebration of the victors of the athletic contests. They develop human personality in a lyric way that was never seen in the world before. So you have Aeschylus and Pindar developing at the same time lyric poetry and Greek tragedy, drama and lyric poetry come into being at the same time. They're a pair. But we've learned in this education that whenever you find a strong pair like that, there is a formative context within which that pair gains its dynamic. The dynamic is in the pair, but the energy is in the context. And in classical Greek, there are two very distinct words. Energeia and dynamis are quite distinct and quite different. The development of history will always have a dynamic. The dynamics of history. And the first person to spot this was another classical Greek named Thucydides. And we're going to read Thucydides next. His History of the Peloponnesian War, where he puts a finger like a successful general would be able to, exactly on the place where the battle is going to be won or lost. The battle of history is won or lost on the way in which you understand the dynamics of history. But the context of the dynamis of history is the energy of the person. If the person is not able to be energized, history is going to throw you back without asking you anything. No permission, no options, nothing will throw you back on ritual. And in two different ways, you get forked by failure every single time. But if the individual, if the person, if the artist is energized enough, their energy can navigate the dynamics of history and successfully make a transversal, make a crossing. Where does one get to? One gets to, as the Buddha said, the other shore. As we would say today, one gets to the cosmos, the objective heaven. One gets to science. One gets to an objective firmament where one can at last arrive. And the person has a place to be. The mind is objective, and its place to be is in the body. The objectivity of symbols is only sustainable because of the objectivity of the body. But the objectivity of the person, of the artist, is only sustainable in terms of arriving at the objectivity of the cosmos, of the reality of the universe as a living whole. Spiritual man is only real in heaven. As long as he stays on the good earth, he is only provisional. He's only writing in the sand. And that lasts just as long as the next tide doesn't come in. One can easily, as you can see, can put this into very dramatic language. Aeschylus and Pindar put it into very dramatic language. Still readable, still awe-inspiring. There's a new translation of Pindar from Harvard University Press in two volumes, and one is reminded, when I first started reading Greek classic commentaries in the 50s, I remember Sir Maurice Borah writing a book on Pindar, and he said, beware those casual translators of Pindar. He's like some kind of an incredible eagle. And saying of poor translators that one should not take an eagle on a leash for short walks. That's not what you do. Pindar's language needs to be free to soar in lightning, crackling ways that are almost unapproachable. One finds it in Rilke, one finds it in Shelley, One finds it in Pushkin, but in very, very few great poets. Basho, Shakespeare. But no matter how great Pindar and Aeschylus are, they're a strong pair that exist in a context, and the context had the energy. Pindar and Aeschylus had the dynamic, but the context had the energy, and the context was generated by another classical Greek who was a generation older than Pindar or Aeschylus, who were contemporaries. And the classical Greek who was a generation older was one of the most brilliant human beings who's ever lived. His name was Pythagoras. And the Pythagorean context of classical Greece at that time made it possible for the forms of Greek tragedy and lyric poetry to emerge simultaneously. And as soon as they did, a third form, which is the history that Thucydides comes up with, gets posited. And as soon as you have Greek tragedy, lyric poetry, and history, the center of that triad, of that triangle, becomes apparent. And the center of that triangle of forms was the development of philosophy. Philosophy was the getting at that there is a center point to this large triangle of conscious forms, of differential conscious forms, history, tragedy, and poetry, and that at the center, at the focus of those three forms is philosophy, presented in Plato's dialogues. Plato was the amanuensis, he's the one who wrote them down, but the original spark of insight was due to Socrates, who lived it. But the person who first struck the sparks that made the pilot light of Socrates, that made the flame of Plato, was a woman, and her name was Diotima. And Diotima was the Pythagorean. And Diotima embodied the energy of the Pythagorean context of classical Greece. And she's the one that taught Socrates how to maintain an even flame, even though it's just a pilot light, even though you're just one. Nevertheless, you are one. And as long as you maintain your pilot light, at any time that there's tinder, you can start a fire. The state put Socrates to death because they understood that. He didn't have thousands of followers, but he had himself. And he was a jeopardy to the state all by himself because they couldn't blow him out. They couldn't snuff him out. He was approaching 80 years of age. He was burning brightly, plainly, and clearly like he had done for several generations. Plato in his great dialogue, the Phaedo, about the last minutes of Socrates. Socrates says to his young philosophers, lovers of wisdom, don't cry for me, because wherever I'm going, I'm going to maintain my flame. I'm going to ask questions of whoever is there, wherever I go. What a chance to interview every spirit in the cosmos. With that, he drank the hemlock and died. The Pythagorean context, Pythagoras, is the context within which drama and lyric poetry and later history and then philosophy are all born. So that the discovery of differential consciousness in the Western tradition gains its tenacity, its traction, because of an ability to remember. And remembering is the primal activity of aesthetic form. Art has everything to do with memory. One of the books that we use in Vision by Dame Frances Yates is called The Art of Memory, which we paired with the great illuminations of Hildegard of Bingen. And Dame Frances Yate and Hildegard of Bingen, as a pair, were right at the middle of Vision, the previous set of four. When you have three fours in a row and then a 13th, you have this archetypal structure. Why is it an archetypal structure? Because it goes down to the very essence of the way in which symbolism has evolved in civilization. You have 12 apostles that are gathered around Jesus. You have 12 astrological signs that are gathered around the sun. Jesus is a 13th. The sun is a 13th. It's an archetypal form. It's everywhere that civilization obtains on this particular planet. It's even there in Asia, very powerfully. It's a form sequence that allows for ordinality to be built into the cardinality, because one doesn't just have 12 lectures in a row. One has a set of four, then one has another set of four, a step higher, a third set of four, a step higher, and then a 13th on yet a higher level. One of the easy mnemonic ways to remember the form is a title that the late George Gamow gave to one of his great books on physics. The title of it was 1, 2, 3, infinity. 1, 2, 3, ellipsis, infinity. In fact, in logic, once you can write a form, 1, 2, 3, ... n, it means that this is a universal form. It not only holds in any logical expression, but any mathematical expression whatsoever. It holds in the way in which differential consciousness achieves objective form throughout the cosmos. It doesn't matter what star system you're on. It doesn't matter what galactic cluster you live in. That form holds. You can trust that. But until one is able to remember that and use it, to use it with the energy of your person in the dynamic of history, you're not really convinced, because it's only there that it finally shines and shows itself. And this is exactly where we are in Arndt. We're at the last four, at the third four. We began with Kandinsky and Max Ernst as a pair for 4 weeks. Then we jumped up and we went to Henry Moore and Frank Lloyd Wright. Not that Henry Moore and Frank Lloyd Wright are greater artists than Kandinsky or Ernst. That's not it at all. But it's that the way that we're using them, they're a step up. And now we went to a third step up where we're using Stravinsky and Schiller. Schiller's Aesthetic Letters on the Aesthetic Education of Man and Stravinsky's Harvard Lectures, The Poetics of Music. And those three steps, that third step prepares us, brings us to the threshold of a great realization, because one more ordinal step and we're free. And so one has to be very attentive. One has to be differentially quite alert. What fourth step would you use in this kind of sequence? When you're using artists on the scale of Kandinsky and Ernst and Moore and Wright and Stravinsky, and as aesthetician like Schiller, who are you going to use to follow them? I use Emily Dickinson. Because Emily Dickinson happens to be like Pindar. She's one of the world's greatest lyric poets, bar none. She's easily as great as Pindar or Basho. And it's in Emily Dickinson's pithy little lyric poems that one gets the poignancy to brave the rigors of this world. This world that is trapped largely in a time or cardinality that the only way to live with it realistically is to fold in with it and get by like everybody else. Let's get in line and just get by. Which, if you get the least bit alert, is not going to do. It's not satisfying. You can't live with just getting by. That's not enough. But in order to take one step into freedom takes too much courage. One of the greatest epic poets of all time, a Roman, who turned his poetry into a scientific treatise, Lucretius, who wrote De Rerum Natura, about the way in which nature works. We read it today as if it were an early scientific treatise by a Roman, and what did he know? But when you read it on scale of Virgil and Ovid, that Lucretius was an epic poet, he just turned his epic language, his poet language, into describing nature as best he could. A good translation of De Rerum Natura is the way things are. And Lucretius is famous for a dictum about his own time. This is 50 BC. He said, "We are so sick that we will die of our condition, but we are so weak we cannot stand to employ the cure necessary." Damned if you do and damned if you don't. That's exactly what Schiller said. In the 13th letter, here it is, an English translation. "Since the world is extension in time, the perfection of that faculty which connects man with the world will have to consist in maximum changeability and maximum extension. But that requires a courage which is almost impossible. It's a cure which is too strong for us. Because the very powers that allow us to survive in just getting by in the cardinal sequence have to be completely scrambled. They have to be transformed. They have to be changed and get into this ordinal stepping. We can't do that, can we?" So what happens? Schiller says, instead of getting free, everything turns upside down. We would use psychological language today, say we fall into a regression. Instead of going into a progression, we, by doing what we do ineptly, advance to a regression. And we advance with great certainty and great pomp and great fanfare into a regression. Almost every seminar, every cure that you can see advertised today, and the more they're advertised, the more they are regressions. What does Schiller say? "But a man can turn these relations upside down and thus miss his destiny in two different ways, pair of ways. He can transfer the intensity required by his active function. He can transfer that intensity to the passive. Let his sensuous drive encroach upon the formal and make the receptive faculty do the work of the determining one. Or he can assign to the active function that extensity which is proper to the passive. Let the formal drive encroach upon the sensuous and substitute the determining faculty for the receptive one. In the first case, he will never be himself. In the second, he will never be anything else." Do you get it? These are the horns of the bull. You wonder why is that symbol of the bull there? in early civilization all the time. What the hell has a bull got to do with civilization? Because it's that stubborn willfulness that succeeds at staying where it is and will not change that gaffs us forever. And where one finds human beings, men and women, who successfully challenge that bull, one finds an acrobatic consciousness. One of the most beautiful murals ever found, Sir Arthur Evans found it on Crete when he was excavating the Palace of Minos at Knossos in Crete, a 3,000-room palace. And there one finds this great mural that survived all those millennia of this huge bull with its horns, and this man has grabbed the horns and pirouetted, somersaulted, is somersaulting over the bull, showing that those people mastered differential consciousness. When did they ever? They were ready for something completely new. And one finds in the same palace room, along with the bull and the pirouetting athlete, one finds this wave form. The border is no longer a cardinal border of just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's this waves of sets. Waves always occur in sets. Anyone who lives on a seacoast knows that. And if you learn the sequence of the sets of waves, you can come ashore or you can go out. You can set sail or you can dock, because you can work within the sets of waves. And so the sets of waves of Minoan, Mycenaean Greece become the formal borders of classical Greece, because that border that has those squares that are within each other are geometric waves. And in the early 20th century, when the finest architect of our age looked for a symbol, his original symbol were two of the Greek waves in a complementation, done in red. Frank Lloyd Wright. Later on, to disguise it, he made it just a red square. A red square of attention. Because he learned, like all great artists, that you have to sometimes disguise wisdom in this world. Because people will misinterpret, not on the basis of wanting to misinterpret, but because they didn't put enough personal energy into mastering it in the first place. Art requires a lot of energy. And there's nothing worse than a halfway artist. A halfway artist will botch up everything. Will squander the meaning, squander the forms, so that when a real artist comes along, he has to have new forms. You can't use these, they've been squandered. Everyone's tired of these. And so the difficulty in art is to find times when some new form is necessary, except in very peculiar ages like our own. In our own, we live in an age where there have been so many new forms that new forms in themselves are the legacy of halfway artists for the last 4 or 5 generations. And so an artist like Stravinsky, a world-class artist like Stravinsky, faced with the problem, the musical aesthetic problem, what kind of form is he going to use? He needs a different form. Should he go for a new form? Stravinsky, in his genius, decides to take an old form that was completely out of date for 100 years and revive it. To do two things at once. To have the old form revived is, in essence, a new form. And also, by going back 100 years and enlivening that form and giving it a new differential history, in effect, taking what was the mainstream and making it a side stream, rechanneling the major flow of the river. If you make what was originally a side stream a deeper channel, then the river will flow in the side stream, and that will be the river. And what was the river will shrink and become a side stream. And that's what Stravinsky did in music. He did that in the 1920s. Because the whole musical scene was completely dominated during the 20s and especially into the 1930s, and by the beginning of 1939, 1940, when he gave these lectures at Harvard, the world was drowning in the mistakes of the new forms in music that had come in that Stravinsky, I think we can use the term, hated. He reviled. He reviled especially the musical forms known as musical drama. That musical drama had been a pastiche that was not descended from the Aeschylean, from the Greek tragedy, but was a pastiche of things that eventually leads to a dead end, a box canyon. The maker of musical drama was Richard Wagner. And Wagner wanted to make an all-time new musical form. So he brought everything together in his musical drama. It wasn't exactly music, it wasn't exactly drama, it wasn't exactly opera, it wasn't exactly this or that. He wanted everything, all together. The phrase that would have been used as uber alles, and it was, an art to end all art. All art from now on is going to follow this tradition. And Stravinsky refused to be a good German. For one thing, he was never German. He was Russian who practiced in France, and so he knew the French idiom very well. In fact, he was one of the makers of the modern French idiom. But he also knew the Russian idiom very well. His musical teacher was Rimsky-Korsakov, who understood very well the Russian tradition in music. And he used to say to Stravinsky, look, Russian musical form has advanced to Tchaikovsky. And in Tchaikovsky, it's not his symphonies, not his incidental music, but in Tchaikovsky, it's his ballets. The Tchaikovsky ballet is one of the greatest potential musical forms to rival the operatic musical drama of Wagner. If you need something to match up to the Ring of the Nibelung, take Swan Lake. It'll hold itself. You want to talk about Valkyries and Götterdämmerungs? In the same breath, you can talk about Swan Lake. And so Stravinsky, from Rimsky-Korsakov, learned the Tchaikovsky tradition in Russian ballet music, and he took as the origin of that the same origin that Rimsky-Korsakov and Tchaikovsky took, that there was a genius in Russian music named Glinka. Died in 1842, wrote operas before the Wagnerian operatic music drama syndrome got really a strong hold in Europe, before it became the tradition. And so Stravinsky goes back to Glinka, he has an ear for Tchaikovsky and for Rimsky-Korsakov, but Stravinsky most of all has himself. And an artist on scale of Stravinsky, here he is at age 88, looking at the world. Yes, I am here. Who the hell are you? And what do you want? Now, one of the peculiar things about Stravinsky was a Russian who was able to write a la Française in France, but because of German weather in Europe in the 1930s, he moved to the United States for his health. And he moved to the most throwaway part of the United States. He moved to Los Angeles. We're not talking about San Marino or Beverly Hills. We're talking about Hollywood. He moved to Hollywood. And when he got to Hollywood, he looked across his fence and his neighbor was Aldous Huxley. They got into this conversation, as Stravinsky and Huxley would have gotten into a conversation. What are we going to do about the goddamn Germans? What are we going to do, Stravinsky would say, about Wagner? His ruined music. We got this Uber Ali stuff everywhere. What to recalibrate? And Huxley said, well, you know, Huxley was 6'7", and Stravinsky was like 5'3". He said, Igor? I think he must have called him Igor. He said, Igor, why don't you do a new kind of opera to outdo Wagner? And make it sexy. So Stravinsky, being this universal elf, can you imagine a 5-foot elf in spats and top hat and everything? That's Stravinsky. He's sort of a Fred Astaire type character. He remembered being aroused erotically by a show in Chicago at the Art Institute. They were showing engravings by Hogarth. This is the first of two. This is called Before. There's one called After. But what got him was a series of 8 engravings by Hogarth called The Rake's Progress. Hogarth made a lot of money by making these very sophisticated, elegant, erotic engravings in series, especially, and he was making a lot of money on something called The Harlot's Progress. So since he had done the female side, he was going to do the male side. So he did The Rake's Progress, 8 plates, and Stravinsky, talking to Huxley, suddenly thought, I'm going to write an opera called The Rake's Progress. And it's going to be this tableau, this ordinal tableau. Instead of the Wagnerian river of continuous melody, because what Wagner instituted was, I can never remember the German word for all conforming. You see it in all the Nazi films. Everything has to conform into one ribbon of authority. And Wagnerian music moves in this great river, this torrent of conformity. Or continuity, musical, dramatic continuity. And everything weaves itself into this. That's the power of Wagnerian music. And that's one of the world's great music forms. It's exquisite, and one can give oneself to it, and it's like being carried by the Mississippi River in flood tide. In fact, it's so gorgeous that one uses the incidental music from Die Meistersinger of Nuremberg for the marriage ceremony. It's triumphal beyond belief. But Stravinsky refused to be triumphal beyond belief. And when we come back from the break, we'll take a look at this in a further light. Let's take a break. This is an educational form that's like a yoga. And every yoga builds what's called tapas. And tapas is an energy, an energeia. And that energy will not go to the next ordinal level until you have completely filled the previous level. And so the way that one does a yoga is to make sure that one is complete, so that the rising is not due to willpower or ambition, but due to this natural flow. And when you feel that, you feel the intensity of the energy have integrity. And it has a quality which is very eerie, which is very peculiar and special. The American visionary Buckminster Fuller coined a word. He called it tensegrity. Integrity with a tensile strength. And what happens with tensegrity is instead of distributing itself along a plane, it distributes itself along a sphere. And the discovery of geodesic spheres was a visualization of tensegrity, because Fuller could do his own kind of yoga. A similar thing happened in the classical world. They used a plane geometry for a long time, and when they filled that capacity, all of a sudden, unbidden, as like a gift from heaven, they developed out of geometry into trigonometry. Someone who works on a geometric plane with precision is Aristotle, but someone who works on a trigonometric sphere with consummate accuracy is Plotinus. And there's all the difference in the world between Aristotle and Plotinus. Aristotelian forms become curled sheets of paper in a vast universe that Plotinus is at home in. And it was only the crash of the psyche in the 3rd century, 4th century, in the classic West that confused the two. In fact, some pages of Plotinus and some pages of Aristotle were put together and formed a book called, in medieval centuries, called Isagoge. And everyone thought, this is the epitome of the classics' wisdom. And it was a pastiche of Plotinus and Aristotle. And it was used as a textbook for 1,000 years. And because it was inculcated ritually into students for 1,000 years, they inculcated two incommensurate things that never would fit together. And it led to a split in the Western mind, a body-mind split that was built, that was inculcated, that was taught into the Western mind. And when human beings first again learned to read Greek well enough to tell the difference in styles, one could see that these pages are totally different from these pages. It's a totally different person, totally different style, separated by 700 years of sophistication. I mean, there's no one that confuses Beowulf and Milton. There's no way to confuse them. One of the curing developments out of being able to tell the difference in styles was the development of the Enlightenment. And in the Enlightenment, the sense of style was a very important way of telling who's who. It was like giving you a scorecard. It was like giving you a dramatis personae. Because one began again to be able to differentiate quite accurately the players and not to confuse them. And so one again got the sense of the great drama of ideas, the great fantastic play that goes on that we're involved in. And the true issues, the true challenges, were able to be seen. Schiller comes at the apex of the Enlightenment. But the Enlightenment, when it sought to make a step revolutionarily into history, to really change everything, slipped and fell. That was the French Revolution. That looked so promising when it began, and as it went on, it turned into a tyranny that deepened, and today we call that era of French history the Terror. Because the only resolution finally was whoever wasn't with you should be killed. The forerunners of Nazi Germany are in the French Revolution in France. So one has a very peculiar kind of history, which we inherit swallowed whole and unresolved. And the last time that this happened was when the Roman Empire swallowed the Greco-Egyptian classical world whole, unresolved. And it led to a tummy ache that resulted in finally a seesaw between two opposites that are both unacceptable. One was an authoritarian empire, the Roman Empire, and the other was the Dark Ages, where nothing held. And we today are exactly at that same threshold. And it's fruitless to cross your fingers and hope for some kind of a planetary empire. And it's just as fruitless to hope that things will loosen up and everything will just get looser. Either way leads to this kind of dilemma that Schiller is writing about. Both are unnecessary. They're totally unnecessary. They are extraneous to reality. But in order to not slide either way, it takes a yoga for a little while in order to learn how to walk. And that's what this education is for. To learn how to walk in this world, in this mind, in this personality that we have, and to make your way in such a style that you can do it your way. But an informed your way, not a willfulness and not a mask-like. But it takes a while to build that quality of familiarity. And that's why it's a yoga. And the continuity, the sealing of your continuity, is the only guarantee that you have that it will work. To the extent that you break it up or that you don't do it, exactly to that extent it won't work. I can't do that for you. If I could do that for you, you should fear me more than anything. I would fear myself. Because if I could do it for you, you would all be clones of me. Faulkner, in his Nobel Prize speech, said, "The really eternal quality of man is his ability to criticize, to just keep talking and complaining, to be forever bitching about conditions." And he said, even if the planet were turned into one paved sphere with stations that would pop up and would fuel your car, your passions, your food, all in one gulp, and then sink back and let you have an unimpeded planet paved to cruise around in, he would still be muttering to himself, "It's no good. It won't work. It's not enough. Can't stand it." It's this quality that is being counted on in this education, that even though you're being given a very powerful new form, I mean a powerful new form, a yoga that is about 20 times the size of Wagner's Ring of the Nibelung. Huge form. I pity the poor criminals who try to use it in a perverse way. They'll have to spend most of their life mastering it to figure out some clever way to misuse it. And by that time, they'll be too old to really have the energy to do it. But it takes your sealing of it. The old ancient thing was that. It takes your own saliva put on to, in your way, put onto the form to seal it. You have to do it in your own way. And it invites, it will morph into your own way. And the more that you do it, the less it will be something which I do and that I give to you, and the more it will be something which you selectively commandeer for yourself. And the more that you apply it, you will modify it in your own way. After 5 or 6 years, it's quite feasible that you won't even think about any of this and you'll just do it. You'll do it your own way. And that's the way that it should be. But before you can do that, you have to learn how to practice it, how to do it. Your only guarantee is that you do it. You do it. We're looking ahead now. In 2 weeks, we start history, which is the most difficult of all of the phases of this education. No one has ever, ever mastered history in this particular course. We're going to start with a pair of books. We're going to start with Thucydides, the Peloponnesian War, but we're not just taking books as texts, we're always pairing. And the pair to Thucydides is Benjamin Franklin. Franklin's autobiography, a history of himself. But before we get to Franklin and Thucydides, to that pair that begins the first set, the first square of history, we need to finish up this last third square of art with Stravinsky and Schiller. But in between Stravinsky and Schiller, the four lectures making a square on Stravinsky and Schiller, and the four lectures which will make a square of Franklin and Thucydides, we have that interval of Emily Dickinson. So if you're doing this, the conscientious thing is to make sure at least that you have these five books and that you stack the Poetics of Music on the Aesthetic Education of Man, and then you stack a copy, a translation of Franklin's autobiography on Thucydides, History of the Peloponnesian War, and you put a copy of Poems of Emily Dickinson in between. And there it is on the table. That's what's going on here. But Emily Dickinson, in order to operate, cannot be seen as a bridge between those two. She is an interval between those two sets. She's the inner space of a square which would be made if one were doing some kind of an imaginative cardinal sequence. One would have at one corner Stravinsky, at another corner Schiller, at another corner Thucydides, and at a fourth corner Franklin. But the whole center space would be Emily Dickinson. It takes a lot of attention, a lot of attentiveness, a lot of concentration, dhyana, in order to find that that space fills all those four corners without connecting the dots. One of the qualities of a true interval is that it's an interval. It's not a content space within a box. It's within, and it's also the context without. And one of the most powerful presentations of that kind of contextual background is Pythagoras. The Pythagorean contextual background allowed for all the classic Greek forms to emerge and to be what they were. They were very defined. Clarity of form was a particular style of classical Greece. When Pericles manhandled the councils of Athens to get the Parthenon built, the Parthenon was built to a T. None of the columns were straight up. They were all slightly slanted, ever so slightly, in order to give a tensegrity to the whole structure. The Parthenon stood almost untouched by the ravages of millennia. It was almost impossible for the wear and tear to injure, to destroy the tensegrity of the Parthenon. Why is it in the ruins that it is today? Because the Turks stored their ammunition there inside the building and it blew out. And the classical Greeks never thought in their wildest imagination that there would be a powerful force inside the Parthenon to blow its structure out. Otherwise, it would have stood all this time and still been there. This kind of education produces a tensegrity, not only of your body and mind integrally, but of your personality and the cosmos differentially. You get related to the cosmos, just like your mind gets related to your body. What mind-body split? And so the symbol that we use for it is this infinity sign. That the differential and the integral go together. They make a unity. I guess I have a page now that doesn't have the big infinity sign. We're redoing it. The small infinity sign here we'll have to do. Or here it is on the cover. The infinity sign is also a bow. The very movement that would tie a knot ties a bow if you use an ordinal stepping order. The same dynamic movements that make for a plane of cardinal sequencing make for tying an infinity sign. But you have to engineer, you have to design. Someone has to plan for this. Some architect has to make this work so that it works that way, so that that infinity bow gets tied. Because we live in a context that is not pure. We live in minds, we live in a world which are so scrambled by now that if you just let nature work, it ties knots. If you live without any kind of conscientiousness in this world, you will end up with heart attacks, stomach problems, confusion, all by itself. That's the way nature works in this kind of context. Cardinal, straight lines in a corrupt context will tie knots. Knots are single-dimensional lines that are self-avoiding in a three-dimensional context. So if you do nothing, you're tying knots already. That's what happens. If you try to live naturally and return to nature, that's what will happen. It's like a demonic curse. The more that one tries to be natural in this world now, the more that you tie knots. You don't have to do anything. You have to be ignorant. You don't have to be guilty. You don't have to not want it or to want it. It doesn't make any difference. All of those modifications are extraneous to the actuality. And yet, the ability to tie bows rather than knots takes an attentiveness to follow through that motion at least one cycle, so that instead of tying the knot, you tie the bow. And that's where the yoga comes in. That's where it's very difficult to do. It's not that it's intellectually difficult. One doesn't have to understand a thing. One has to simply do it, to go through not the paces, but to go through the dance steps, because your body will remember. Your mind will remember. Once you learn to ride a bicycle, once you learn to type, you didn't have to tell your body to remember, it did remember. You sit down to a keyboard and you can type. You get onto a bicycle, you can ride, you have balance. But there was a time when you had to learn how to do that. This education is learning how to learn. Learning how the integral that comes together and the differential that opens out work together in a complementation. And once they work, they always work, and they will work, and you can do it your way. Indefinitely. Now let's come back here. Let's come back to Stravinsky. Let's come back to Schiller. Let's come back to today. We've got another lecture on them next week, and we'll pursue to the nth degree what we're raising today. Let's come back and let's review something. Here's Schiller in the 13th letter, aesthetic letters. Why did he use a letter form? Because in the Enlightenment, this personal communication, a letter was always from someone to someone else, from someone definitely to someone else. Letter writing was one of the great forms that came at that time. When one wanted to write from yourself, like in a third person universal form, to a third person, everybody out there, then you chose the essay. The essay was from the universal you to the universal them. The personal you to the personal you was the letter. So the essay and the letter were Enlightenment forms. They were like a complementation. One finds, for instance, one of the great Enlightenment novels by Richardson, Pamela, is a series of letters that makes up the novel. One finds enormous correspondence. An Enlightenment figure like Benjamin Franklin, his correspondence now runs to 30 volumes, and it's only 3/4 of the way through. One finds this kind of a form. So here, Schiller is writing after the fall of the French Revolution, after the very flower of the Enlightenment had not only wilted, but had begun to stink. And he's trying to understand for himself and to convey this understanding to someone else in a series of letters. What's wrong? What's going on with man? What's going on with us? What is operating in us that does this? What kind of situation are we in? What kind of a history are we in where this happens? And at this time, the great correspondent of Schiller is not the man to whom these letters were written, the aesthetic letters. His great correspondent at this time is Goethe. And the correspondence of Goethe and Schiller forms two huge volumes. So these letters are like a gold ribbon that one could tie around the great voluminous correspondence of Goethe and Schiller, who understood each other, who understood the conditions. But whereas Goethe was determined to exemplify some master form that would take in the mysteries of transformation, it was apparent to them that one had to move from a certain kind of a mode of happening to a distinctly different mode. One had to move from getting the ideas clear, like the classical Greeks had, to opening them up so that they could be used in new ways, in new situations that the classical Greeks never faced. They were not there. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, if the classical Greeks architects had had steel and glass, we wouldn't have to do a lot of thinking. But here they are. There are new elements in human life that weren't faced before. They didn't have them. They didn't have genetic manipulation. They didn't have radioactive waste. They didn't have dozens and dozens and dozens of aspects that are now there. So we have to think this through. We have to not only think it through, but we have to put that thought into motion in ourselves, in our own lives. We have to not only think it through, we have to live it through in our persons. And we have to find some way where the existential certainty of the body and the cosmic objectivity find the other two corners and make some great square of stability that can happen. Existence is pretty definite. Its corner is not going to go away, not very easily. And the cosmos is very definite. It's really there. But the other two corners are very problematical. The objectivity of the mind and the objectivity of the artist person are very much up for grabs. And it's that diagonal that's in jeopardy. It's that diagonal that's the scar on the face of Frankenstein. And if that's not handled, then the Superman will be a terror, will be a real Nietzschean nightmare. We've only come up against, so far, picayune sketches of the kind of demons that can really be there. We were exhausted, when I was a child, to the point of almost oblivion, dealing with the Nazis, dealing with Stalinist Russia. But they're nothing compared to the real tyrannies of super individuals that will come in the next century. The science fiction films haven't even opened up the horrific problems that will come. I remember one successful episode in the old Star Trek about a genetically engineered master race that were put to sleep in a spaceship. The leader was a man named Khan. And then they made a Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, where he comes back into play. It's that kind of a nightmare that's a real possibility. And the only way to temper that kind of ravage is to have a population of people who know what they're doing and who are not manipulable by someone like that. But someone who stacks the deck, who genetically engineers you before you're born, who puts in nanocomputers and every molecular structure in the whole physical plant so that anything that you touch is going to work their way. Doesn't matter what kind of swordsman you are. You can be Conan Infinite. There's nothing you can do against that. Then you have to go back to what the old Bhagavad Gita says. God will not permit that. Then he sets a real superhero against the false superhero. Then an Arjuna has set in. In the Mahabharata, where Drona, the warrior instructor, is instructing the greatest marksman of the day, He wants them to shoot this model of a bird, this eagle. And he says to them before they shoot the arrows, "What do you see?" And they describe one after another, great accuracy, the shape of the eagle, and the beak and the curved head. And when it comes to Arjuna, he says, "I see nothing." Because he's looking only into the pupil of the eye of the eagle. He sees nothing. That kind of superhero does not look to see what's there, but is accurate for what is not there every single time. But if you wait until that exigency, because that's like last exigency, that's a lot of generations of suffering. There's no need to do that. So this kind of education is meant to forestall that kind of a crisis by the end of the 21st century. And it's made not to be popular now, but to work whenever it's put into operation. This generation largely doesn't need it because they don't care. But the grandchildren are going to care a lot because there won't be any way to avoid the fact that it's worse than bad. Here's what Schiller said 200 years ago already. Since the person with a capital P, is persistent with change, no matter how reality changes, the person who is a differential form and not an integral form changes with the changes. The I Ching says, the superior man is the bridge between heaven and earth. But you have to read a little further because it then says, heaven suspends its symbols. The earth founds its symbols, anchors them, but heaven suspends its symbols. So man has to be the bridge between something which is anchored and something which is suspended. And if you choose one or the other, if you choose to be anchored, then you try to anchor yourself in a heaven which doesn't hold anchored things. It suspends everything. Or if you go the other way and you get used to suspension and you try to suspend your anchor in earth, it turns into anger, Freudian slip. Because the earth doesn't permit that. The earth doesn't permit differentiation. She likes things this way. Mother Nature is very particular. She likes it her way. My Father Heaven doesn't like that way. He likes a different way. Mother Nature likes a pure hitter who can hit the ball. Father Nature likes good pitching. They're never going to hit that ball. Two completely different ways. And you have to be the bridge between the two. How do you do that? You can't mulch them together. You can't splice. Bridging is not splicing. The Taoist bridging is that one makes a pirouetting leap, a ballet movement. One is able to leap from the earth into the freedom of heaven. One is able to drop from the freedom of heaven onto the earth. On your feet. It's this kind of a quality. One has to be able to do both. 30 years ago, they used to say both and never understand what they were saying. It isn't both and in some way that meets, because both and in that way, logically, are disjunctive polarities. They only meet in some imaginative projection. So you can't do that and make it work. You can imagine it and then hope that's what's going on and pretend, but that doesn't really happen. Why? Schiller, 200 years ago. Since the person is persistent within change, the perfection of that faculty which is to oppose change, will have to be maximum autonomy and maximum intensity. Freedom and energy. The more facets his receptivity, capital R, the more facets, like a jewel, cut with more and more facets. The person is like a jewel, is like a fine jewel that scintillates more and more, with more and more facets. The more facets his receptivity develops, the more labile it is, and the more surface it presents to phenomena. So much more world does man apprehend. In other words, if you're just a simple plane, you mirror the situation. And if you can't look at the situation and see it for what it is, at least you look at the mirror and you see what it is for you. But if someone is a plain mirror, you can only mimic, you can only imitate, you can only reflect what's going on out there. And if that's chaos, what are you reflecting? You're thinking, that's me. I'm in chaos. But the more differentially developed you are, instead of being just a mirror, you begin to have facets like a jewel. Then the whole spherical reality of the world has to come into play and does come into play. And stupidity is not very elegant. It doesn't really capture the whole sphere of things. It's just one or two places or a couple of areas. And so you learn that the confusion is only here. It's not everywhere else. It's just here. Why is it here? Oh, because of this. So that differentiation helps analysis. It helps you, instead of just complaining because you're reflecting what's going on in a mimicking, autonomous, unconscious way, one begins to be able to differentiate. Here's where the confusion is, because of thus and so. And you can see it. The more facets his receptivity develops, the more labile it is, and the more surface it presents to phenomenon, so much more world does man apprehend. And all the more potentialities does he develop in himself. You realize that you may have a thousand, a million, a billion different facets. You can develop as many as you would like. But you start to look for strategies of development that are not just simple development of some mirror-like surface, but you want to develop whole patterns. Instead of some Pavlovian model where the understanding is that you ring the bell and the dog salivates. The Pavlovian arc reflex, so that then your education is built around arc reflex stimulation inculcation. The answer is yes or no. If you say no, you're hit. Eventually you will learn to say yes. Very limited. But instead of the Pavlovian reflex arc, if you realize that the neural system works by billions of neuronal cells working together like illuminated clouds that have this heat lightning flashing all over, then your education has to be different, doesn't it? Then you don't want to train somebody by reflex arcs. You don't have them to salivate by bells. You want to train them to have this kind of heat lightning creatively throughout their whole neuronal billions of cells. Then you get a different kind of education. You get a different kind of human being. Then you get a human being who, instead of tying knots in their life, begins to do ballets. Instead of singing assigned roles in someone else's opera, you begin to do the choreography of your own production. And you find the more that you do this, that you have a talent for freedom. and variation. You have a fantastic talent for that. Stravinsky admires Haydn. He says Haydn was this genius before the Wagnerian takeover of the development of German music. He doesn't mention it, but Stravinsky also was very close to Brahms, because Brahms admired the way in which Haydn made musical structure. In fact, one of Brahms's most engaging works is Variations on a Theme of Haydn. And creative algorithmic variation was a specialty of Brahms long before computer algorithms became genetically evolutionary. One looks at the genius of a Brahms and one understands that this portly man there in Hamburg is real genius. That he got differential consciousness real good. And if you want to look to an anecdote to the conundrum of Wagner, you don't even have to go to the 20th century. It's right there in Brahms already. Understood very completely. Understood music very well. And one hears something like the Violin Concerto by Brahms, and you can hear a kind of music that so outdistances the Wagnerian flow, because Brahms is already aware that it isn't so much the flow that has the energy, it's the resonances that have the energy. And you don't put all of your stuff into just the flow, but you put a lot into the way it resonates. And that resonance has its own principles and laws called harmony. And that music not only has a melodic line that can be Wagnerianly strong, but it has a harmonic feel that can be done with such power and nuance, such delicacy and consummate artistry, that after you learn to hear in a Brahmsian way, Wagner seems like a very talented high school student. It's great fun. It's wonderful entertainment. But when you sit down to really open yourself up, you might listen to some of Brahms' Lieder. It takes a human voice that takes a melodic line that's very thin compared to an operatic line of Wagner, but has resonances that are incredible. And the Brahms' Lieder is a development of the Mozarts, the Mozartian exploration of personal musical form. The way in which we talked about last week that Mozart just opened whole new infinities, whole new scales of musical experience. And if one sees a Wagner development in the middle of Mozart and Brahms, one doesn't have to criticize German music too much. But Stravinsky was giving these lectures, The Poetics of Music, in the winter of 1939-1940. He'd been driven out of Europe. He'd been driven out of his Russia. He'd been driven to the ends of the earth, to Los Angeles. And when he began to really meditate on the problems of opera, he says in here that Mavra, his first opera, was a revolution for him. But the actual great revolution came with the Rake's Progress. And it wasn't just Aldous Huxley leaning over the fence and telling Igor to outdo Wagner at his own game. Huxley suggested to him a poet who could write a libretto for him. He suggested W.H. Auden. And so Auden and Stravinsky got together. Auden did the libretto, and Stravinsky did the music. What a combination. What a murderer's row. And Auden and Stravinsky met together up here on North Weatherly Drive in Los Angeles for 10 intense days, sorting this out, getting the way in which this ordinal presentation would happen. That the rake's progress would be a series of like tableaus that were arranged in this ordinal jumping, but that the style in which they would be presented would be back in the old Enlightenment style in the 18th century. Taking the era of Hogarth, when he did his engravings for the Rake's Progress, the 1730s. So they went back 200 years to get the style, and they looked towards the future to put that style into an ordinal form, which was a differential form. Almost no one has listened to Stravinsky's opera, The Rake's Progress, with the kind of ears that Stravinsky himself or Auden himself would have had. Because it's easy to mistake it that these guys went back to something that was old and tired, was out of date by at least 100 years. But what Stravinsky was doing was recalibrating the sequential capacity of the human musical ear, recounting the cardinal sequence so as to work in an ordinal jumping so that you would no longer count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then say 10. But one would count 1, 2, 3, 40, 50, 60, 700, 800, 900, 10,000. And you would do that just as easily as counting from 1 to 10. That one would learn this new differential form of music by using an old Enlightenment content. More next week. Thank you.